Hello and welcome to the Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. I had the great privilege and pleasure to sit down with one of England's great historians, Robert Toombs. We discussed his book, The New Edition, The English and Their History, but we talked about the attack on history, the long differing histories of England, of Britain, national identity, what it is to be English, what it is to be British, what it is to be European, what it is to be Western. We talked about the slave trade. We talked about the American War of Independence and the alternative histories that we are not being taught in schools. And we talked about what we need for social cohesion. All of this and much, much, much more. But before you hear the episode, I ask if you want to support me, if you want to support the show, please press the subscribe button. If you press the subscribe button, I can have more brilliant guests like Robert Toombs discussing the important issues that you want to hear about. But without further ado, Robert Toombs. You're listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. Professor Robert Toombs, thank you for having me here at St. John's College, Cambridge. A great pleasure, and you're one of the country's most esteemed historians, so it's really a privilege for me to speak with you.
Well, it's very kind of you to say so, that rather exaggerating my merits.
Not at all, not at all. I really recommend your book, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But if we can start, you've written a rather pessimistic piece in The Telegraph about the state of the country of Britain. So may I start by asking, is the West doomed?
Well, we all hope not. I mean, I think it's clear to many people that we're entering a new historical period. After a lifetime of peace, prosperity, at least in the West, in which we felt that we'd entered a new period of history in which things were going to be getting better for always. Progress at last seemed to have reached some sort of fruition. You know, people often say things like, how can this be happening in the 21st century? As if the 21st century had somehow solved all of humanity's problems. And I think we're realizing now that we've lived through a period of very unusual peace, prosperity, and order in the West, and that it may be that this is coming to an end.
So I want to kind of get to grips as well with what is the West? What is it to be English? And I'm going to ask about that first. But what is it this, before we get there, what is this carnage? What is this undoing? What are you referring to when you speak of an end of peace?
Well, I think we can see when we look round us a whole lot of, let's say, challenges, to put it in fairly neutral terms. We see that our own economies are no longer as successful as they once seemed to be. We see that the ideas that many of us espoused as being in some ways universal ideas, the ideas of human rights, for example, of liberties, of the idea that democracy was a system that would eventually embrace most of the world, these ideas are suddenly being challenged by the rise of countries which do not share these basic ideas, which in many cases combat them very, very forcefully, and also a lack of confidence within ourselves that the things that we once took for granted are in fact true or are worth defending. Mm-hmm. And apart from that, the rise of states that are not simply different from us, but which are antagonistic to us, and which make no secret of their hopes of overturning a system that we felt when I say we, I mean the West, which we're going to talk about in a minute, had somehow built over the last 50 years, but in many ways over the last several centuries. Mm-hmm. So what seemed to be the universal progress of mankind, if you were an optimist, now seems like a dead end or the end of an era. Mm-hmm.
So I'm assuming then you're meaning China, Russia, there's an axis of sort of Iran, Qatar, maybe, and a few groups in the Middle East. What is this adversary from without? We'll get to within later, but without, these states that want to undermine us. Who are you referring to?
Well, precisely those, and I think a sort of loose, not exactly an alliance, but a loose alignment of states who feel that the order that the West has created is something that does not serve their interests or their ambitions or their beliefs, and who have formed a kind of loose anti-Western association, mm-hmm. which really does aim to disrupt mm-hmm. the present order of the world. Mm-hmm. A very imperfect order. I mean, there's no golden age ever. I think historians probably all understand that. And so, yes, it's possible to say, well, look at the awful things the West has done. Look at how many wars there have been. Look at the fact that many people are starving and all that. Yes, all that's obviously true. Nevertheless, it's probably been in many ways a period in which all these things had been improving. Mm-hmm. You know, world poverty had been improving. Mm-hmm. The number of people who were destitute and starving had been reducing. Things that we thought were almost inevitable and now we realise are not.
What's been most concerning to me is that from within the country, we're letting it happen. And I've been very alarmed by, you kind of go into this in this article, something, a word coined, I think, by Oriana Fallaci, libricide, which is that liberalism would tolerate that which would not tolerate liberalism. Now, she talks about that philosophically. In your article, you talk about it in how, in the institutions. So liberals have for years, for centuries, tried to bolster institutions to act against big government, or the state rather. And those institutions have been taken over. So I wondered if you could expand on that and if we can focus on what's happening in at home and in Britain.
Big question. I mean, I think you're right in saying that the one of the fundamental assumptions of liberalism, which is a 19th century concept, is that the problem or the danger to be averted was the danger of some sort of state dictatorship, the dictatorship of the majority, for example, or the dictatorship of some sort of dictatorship by states. And of course, we saw plenty of examples of that in the 20th century. And therefore, if you were a liberal, if you lived in a liberal state, you wanted essentially to weaken the powers of the state, mm-hmm. and to decentralize power as much as you could. And so we created, and when I say we, I mean, okay, we'll talk about what we mean by the West, I guess, but a whole lot of institutions which were meant to diffuse authority, what we often call the quango state now. Mm-hmm. But many of our great institutions, if we take British examples, things like the universities, the BBC, have a degree of independence of government authority. And most of us would have thought that this was a very good thing. Mm-hmm. But what's happening now is that the threat, if that's not putting it in too melodramatic a way, or at least, let's say, the danger to many of the liberties that we took for granted comes not from the central authority of the state, but from small groups of people who have taken control of institutions, which instead of being used as buttresses of liberty, mm-hmm. have in some cases become sources of a kind of intellectual tyranny. Mm-hmm. People are self-censoring. In some cases, people are being censored, are being cancelled, are losing their jobs, are being shunned by their workmates or their neighbours in the name of some sort of ideology which is being forced on us by small activist minorities, mm-hmm. and which the majority is, I think, pretty well at a loss to know how to respond.
Mm. Are you seeing that here at the university? It seems like the academy is one of the biggest examples. I mean, I come from a creative industries background and it's pretty bad there, but the academy seems to be even worse. The numbers of cancellations from universities is higher than any other industry, so to speak.
Yes, I expect it is, though I think the situation in this country is much less serious than it is in North America. And I guess to some extent, perhaps in other English-speaking countries, in Canada, New Zealand or Australia. I mean, I think the thing that you describe has certainly been happening and in very high-profile cases. I don't think that's the case so much in Britain, though one can certainly find cases in which it has happened. And it tends to be in certain areas. I mean, I think we'd probably agree that the most toxic, if I can use that word, or at least the most seriously controversial, and the one that would get you into most trouble, is probably the whole issue of transgender. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say, well, after all, in the great scheme of things, this is actually quite a small problem. It concerns a very small number of people. But it is the thing that, more than anything else, is probably going to get you cancelled or sacked from your job, or even arrested, or at least having the police turn up on your doorstep to talk to you about your tweets, that sort of thing. You know, this would have been completely inconceivable even 10 years ago. Yeah. And now it's become, after all, common enough for us to know that it's happening. Yeah. So I think that sort of thing, anything to do with race, clearly, or anything that can be said to be connected with racism, or anything that creates any sort of seeming discrimination, is also pretty poisonous. And so for people to be accused, even in very innocuous cases, of racism or having racist thoughts, are likely to face either present day or even posthumous cancellation. I mean, can I give you an example of that? I went to the Tate Britain yesterday to see an exhibition. And one of the rooms there, it used to be the restaurant, has a large mural by Rex Whistler, who was a young artist in the early part of the 20th century, and who was killed fighting in Normandy in 1944. So you might think someone who has a pretty good claim to be regarded with some respect. But what's happened now is that the room, after having been closed for 2 or 3 years, I think, has now been opened, but with a large film installation in the middle of the room, in which an actor playing Rex Whistler is being very aggressively interrogated by another actor, supposedly a professor, about his views, his racism, his social habits, the people he mixed with, and so on. So it's really like Rex Whistler being put in the dock. And yet his mural itself is almost invisible. It's in the dark. And I said to one of the staff, it's very dark in there. You can hardly see the mural. And he said, well, the mural's not meant to be the centre of attention now. It's meant to be the film, which is about the artist Rex Whistler being interrogated about his beliefs.
How symbolic. The interrogation of someone long dead, like someone who everyone would conceive of as a patriot, who, you know, fought for liberal democracy, is now being interrogated. Because it's not just individuals. It seems to me that there's been an attack on our history, and we've got to ask, we've got to talk about that. But, you know, the countryside is now deemed racist. The Winston Churchill statue, there's graffiti around the BLM riots. There's graffiti back in 2020 on the statue in Westminster, in Parliament Square, calling him racist. There's an attack on everything, and there's very little celebration. In fact, to even celebrate British values, if we could even identify them, and we'll get to that eventually, but it seems like, as a historian, this must feel like an affront to you, like this is something that you've dedicated your life to.
Well, I mean, historians, I suppose most of us would not think of ourselves as necessarily serving any particular cause. And part of history is always sort of undermining myths and so on. That's, some people would say that's the whole purpose of it. So, you know, a serious historian might well question Churchill's views of empire, for example, or indeed Gladstone's connection with, or his family's connection with, slavery, and Gladstone's own defence of his father, who was a slave owner. Gladstone supported for a time the Confederacy in the American War of Independence, the American Civil War. So, you know, historians always ask questions like this. But I admit that what first got me, let's say, involved in a more active way was in setting up a group called History Reclaimed, was the attack on Gladstone. It was Liverpool University who renamed one of their buildings, which had been called the Gladstone Building, and now it's called something else, on the grounds that Gladstone was connected with slavery. And I thought, well, you know, who was Gladstone? Gladstone was the great liberal statesman of the 19th century, not only in this country, but in many cases was regarded as such across the world. He was a man who supported rights for women, who supported religious tolerance, who opposed imperialism, who was in favour of home rule for Ireland. You know, you name it, progressive causes, Gladstone supported them. And I thought, well, if Gladstone is being regarded as beyond the pale, as someone to be condemned, then everything in our history is being condemned. It's not as if we have both heroes and villains. It's as if we only have villains. Even someone like Gladstone is to be cast as a villain, and therefore the whole of our history and our culture is to be trashed. And that, I think, is a danger to, you know, well, essentially to national cohesion to community solidarity. Mm. I mean, I'm not the only person to say this by a long chalk. It's pretty obvious, I think, to many reasonable-minded people. But what we have is a very, I think, determined activist minority who do indeed want to use history as a way of destroying a sense of probably, perhaps the nation, certainly of the nation as something that we should be happy to be part of and for which we should feel some sort of responsibility, whose welfare and whose interest we can properly support.
I think that that's quite key, and why it's so important, you mentioned social cohesion, is that I think it's John Stuart Mill who talked about collective memory as the underpinning of social cohesion. And I suppose, and I think you go into this into your book, is what is it to be English? Well, it's a collective memory. I think there's also a term historians use, social memory.
Yes.
And so if you attack history, you are, by you're attacking social cohesion. You're disrupting a nation. So it seems fundamental to...
Yeah, of course, it depends how you do it. I think you're right, Mill... of course, does put this forward as a... I don't know if he's the first one. I often think of the French philosopher Ernest Renan. I think he probably got it from Mill. But he gave a lecture in the 1880s called What is a Nation? In which he talked about the basis of a nation being... he put it the willingness to continue living together. And what makes that willingness is the sense of a shared past. I mean, he says something like, you know, shared triumphs, shared disasters, but a sense that you are part of this community living across time. And Edmund Burke talks about a nation as a covenant between the living, the dead, and the yet to be born. So I think, now you might say, oh, well, this is just a myth, isn't it? This is just a political, you know, an imagined community, as it's famously being called. But it is the community we have. And it is the community in which democracy has managed to flourish and indeed to survive. I think it's probably true that a democracy as we would wish it to be does require a nation and a sense of common belonging. Otherwise, why would I want to pay my taxes? You know, these things can dissolve quite easily. You know, there are countries even not too far from here where they have, to some extent, dissolved or never existed. And so what you get is, okay, you have a state and you have a system of government, but in which people are, you know, trying to do the least they can, to get away with as much as they can, not to pay their taxes, not to obey the rules, who regard this as being a kind of imposition, not something that you feel that you ought to be part of, or and indeed a proud and happy to be part of.
What country are you referring to?
I'm not going to say. But I might say a country that I love, which is Italy. But, you know, Italy is a country that exists, it seems, without a great sense of national solidarity, without a very effective government, with high levels of organized crime, the mafia and all its various similar sort of offshoots. And yet the Italians manage. But I think probably most of us would want to live in a country which has... let's say, a higher level of civic responsibility, a greater willingness to fulfil the duties of citizenship, of which tax evasion is clearly not a thing that you would wish to...
Although that might be something that unites the Italians.
It probably is. I mean, I think the Italians have other things. They have a culture that unites them to some extent. I mean, there are big regional differences within Italy. But, you know, I think they are united by their culture. You could say Italy exists... Of course, Italy's quite a new country. It only dates from 1870. Or so, well, 1870, I suppose. So you could say, well, it's a pretty new country, and it has a very strong sense of regional difference. But nevertheless, I guess most of us would think, Italy's perhaps a work still in progress. But it's one in which, perhaps I shouldn't have mentioned Italy, but let's say there are countries in which nepotism, the evasion of citizen responsibilities, high levels of corruption and crime. And I'm not going to mention any other countries, but we can probably all think of examples ourselves in which in which living in those countries is a constant struggle. You know, you have to be constantly working out, you know, who do you have to square? How much is it going to cost you to do this? Can you see a doctor? And so all this kind of thing. we would not want to live in that kind of country, ideally. And until quite recently, we didn't. I fear that we're moving in the direction of a breakdown of civic solidarity. Mm. And in some places, it may already have happened. And I think it's something that we really ought to try to combat. You might say, well, it's too late. You know, we've lost. Liberalism is dead. Distinguished philosopher John Gray, whom I always look forward to reading, has more or less said this. Liberalism is now an illusion. You can't recreate it. All the assumptions of liberalism have gone. And therefore, we're heading for something else. But we don't know what the something else is. And it may well be something that we don't really like.
I think the Italian example is quite a useful one to use because, and as someone who has quite a lot of Italian family, the only thing that seems to unite that country is the national football whenever that comes about. Otherwise, they don't consider themselves as a nation, certainly not in the same way that we do here.
Or did
in England, yeah. What I'm quite keen, I mean, I want to explore these other things, but I wondered what it is to be English. What is it that defines England or Britain for that matter? I asked my production team before rolling, what is it to be English? And they said fantastic answers, which is it's to have a cup of tea and it's to go to the football and eat cake on Sundays. And frankly, I like that answer. It's true. It's, you know, it's true in a true sense, in a kind of, I don't know, it's true to us. Anyway, I wondered what your concept of England was.
I'm not sure I have a concept. I don't think there is a concept. The late Roger Scruton said, when it comes down to it, England is our home. That's how we should think of it. And I think the answers that you were suggesting are that kind of very familiar sense of being part of a kind of extended family, mm-hmm. In which you can basically trust other people. You don't assume that everybody's trying to defraud you or steal from you, and in which there are things that you can relax in doing together. I mean, I don't think we don't have a national ideology. We don't any longer have a national religion, if we ever have had. We don't have a sort of list of things that are what make us English. So I think for that reason, thinking of this as simply the place that we happen to be, this is where we have our existence, is all we need really to say. Mm. And just as you would want to repair the roof on your house without having to have an ideological reason for doing so, it seems to me we want to try to maintain our society because it's the one we inhabit.
I mean, I'm not sure I agree that we don't have a national religion. And actually, this is something you detail from well in your work, from Constantine arriving, I think you'll correct me on that. Was it 587, and then King Alfred, I think you call him the founder of the English nation. He had his doom book. He had the Ten Commandments in. That's the first code that Britain had. I think we are a Christian nation, and there's an argument at the moment: are we a Christian nation or are we a secular nation? But the church is still tied to the state. The king is still head of the church. And our morals, our values have marinated in 1400 years of Christian ethic.
Well, I think in a way you've brought up a number of different points there. We have a state religion, which is the Church of England, dwindling in numbers, it seems. But we've had a variety of religions ever since the Reformation. And of course, we've had religious wars. We had the Civil War was essentially a religious war. Mm. Our politics for several hundred years were dominated by religious differences. So that's why I think that I wouldn't say we have a national religion in that sense of a national, of a single national church. And of course, even less so do we now because of immigration of people of non-Christian backgrounds. But yes, I think Christianity was clearly the basis or one of the bases, the principal foundation, I suppose, of what we would have thought of as our culture, our heritage, our morality, the sort of things that we took for granted as being the right things to do. The sorts of things, at least, that you'd be ashamed for not doing if you were found out, as it were. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, we are a country whose whole culture is coloured by many centuries of Christianity. There's no doubt about that. And even if we're now perhaps entering a secular age, though this secular age, which, you know, 50 years ago people thought was part of the liberal transformation of the world. You know, modernity meant science, and it meant the end of religious beliefs, which were thought of as being essentially belonging to an earlier stage of development. Now we have science, therefore we don't need religion. I mean, Richard Dawkins would I think still say that, but that no longer seems to be true. It's true, or perhaps it's true in the northwestern fringe of Europe, but it's not true in North America. It's not true in Russia. It's not certainly not true in Africa or Asia. And so modernity, there doesn't seem to be a simple link between modernity and secularization, but only in those countries in the Christian world, which probably were predominantly Protestant, and several of which had state churches. And my own, you know, I think it's very often widely thought that a reason why this doesn't extend to the United States of America is because America did not have a state church, and therefore you could choose the church you most liked. Mm-hmm. And churches were in competition to attract people in the way that I suppose for a long time now the Church of England has not really felt itself to be involved in.
Can I ask what you mean by secular though? Do you just mean that we're now a minority Christian country? Or what do you specifically mean by being secular?
I think secular in the fact that most people now do not practice mm-hmm. religion. I think polls often get, people often say they believe in something, or they're spiritual, or they believe in a higher power, or indeed that they believe in God, or indeed that they're Christian. But this seems to be a decreasingly important part of their lives, or their mental framework, as it were. You know, you only have to compare a country like England with a country like Saudi Arabia, let's say. Mm-hmm. Whereas in the 17th century, there would not have been a great deal of difference. The intensity of religious belief and the importance of religion for people's behaviour, including violent behaviour, persecuting behaviour, would have been exactly the same as it is now in the most traditional Muslim countries. But clearly now there's a huge gulf between those countries in which religion is still the foundation of almost all aspects of life, and one in which religion has come to be a matter of personal choice, in which not believing or not practicing a religion is perfectly accepted, which it wasn't, after all, even 100 years ago. Well, 150 years ago, anyway. So I think many of our beliefs, our arguments for legislation, are not based on religious commandments, but are based on some secular idea of right, or of some secular practical consideration, of which economic prosperity is the most important.
But haven't those secular ideas come out of, over a millennium, of Christian thought and ethic? And, you know, the religious wars of the 17th century, they were intra-Christian. Mm. So there was still a union, and Catholics and Protestants have learned to live together. Today, is there, you know, we are living, Christians and non-Christians live together somewhat peacefully in Britain, and hopefully increasingly peacefully, although you suggested earlier that there was parts of the country where it's less peaceful. Don't find it so easy to give up the idea that or rather to accept that we are a secular nation.
I thought you were saying the opposite. Sorry, a secular nation or a Christian nation.
I can't give up I find it hard to accept that we are secular. That those morals that you describe for, let's say, economic prosperity, even that itself has evolved from British Christian thought.
I guess it's evolved from certain varieties of Christian thought, especially perhaps from Calvinism, in which hard work and indeed worldly success were seen as signs of divine favour. The Catholic tradition has been to exalt poverty, after all. By no means all Catholics were poor or wanted to be poor, at least the ideal of poverty was seen as one to be aimed at. Mm. I think So I think, okay, you can argue that certain of our seemingly secular ideas derive somewhere from a Judeo-Christian or Christian tradition. But I think we use those arguments less and less prominently in our national discussion. You know, you might say it is your Christian duty to pay more taxes to fund the National Health Service, but I don't ever remember the last time I heard that argument being made, whereas it would have been made probably in the 1940s, and it would certainly have been, similar arguments would have been made in the 1840s. You know, it would have been your Christian duty to help the poor. We don't so much say that now. And so I think the whole way we think has shed a lot of its religious content. In the 19th century, we mentioned Gladstone before. Gladstone was an extremely driven religious person. Religion was at the centre of his whole political activity. There are one or two politicians now, perhaps, of whom that could be said, but in Gladstone's day, it would have been true of many of them. At least they would have claimed that to be the case. And in Gladstone's case, it clearly was the case. Nowadays, it would be thought of as extremely unusual. And indeed, there have been a couple of recent fairly prominent cases of politicians whose careers have been practically terminated by their admission of their religious belief, which went against the secular trend of progressive, I don't know what you call it, permissiveness, or the recognition of a new kind of morality.
It's interesting that that happens to Christians, but it wouldn't be the same for other religions.
No.
Why do you think there's a difference? Why are Christians treated differently?
Well, the cynical answer, which may be the true answer, is because Christians don't fight back. I mean, after all, there's a Christian tradition of turning the other cheek and so on. But we do have, obviously you're referring to elements of Islam, in which militant Islamists are willing to try to enforce the kind of behaviour within this country that they would think appropriate in Pakistan or the Arab states, in a way that very few, if any, Christians do. I mean,
I don't think it's just Islam. Right? I think no, if you were practicing Jewish, it would.
Well, of course, it's true of some Christian sects. You know, we see it more in America than here. But after all, there are many Christians who believe that abortion is wrong, even that abortion is homicide. And as we know, this has been a major issue in America. So it's not true that this is only Muslims. I agree. But in Britain, at least, I think you'd have to say that Christianity has become an extremely tolerant and indeed in many ways a rather passive religion, which is not willing or does not feel it right to defend its own principles, and has become extremely extremely tolerant even of attacks on itself or attacks on its own co-religionists. You know, we get very upset about attacks on minorities, certain minorities in some parts of the world. There's very little reaction, as far as I can see, from Christian churches, let alone Christian politicians, when it comes to attacks on Christians in Pakistan or
Nigeria. There's been recent attacks across the world.
Whereas, you know, getting back to Mr. Gladstone, I'm not obsessed with Gladstone.
Sure.
But Gladstone led a huge political crusade against what at the time were called the Bulgarian Horrors, which in effect...
I've never heard of them.
In the 1870s, there was a rebellion in Bulgaria, which was then part of the Ottoman Empire. And it was very harshly crushed by Ottoman irregular troops. And this was seen as an attack on Christians by Muslims, which in some ways it was. And there was a huge amount of public disquiet, especially on the liberal side, and attacks on the conservatives and attacks on Disraeli, because for reasons of policy, Disraeli was a supporter of the Ottoman Empire. But Gladstone was willing to see the Ottoman Empire, it seemed, be dissolved, because he saw it as a tyranny, and a tyranny particularly aimed in this case at Christians. So again, religion at that time was a huge political issue, and the willingness to protect Christians who were being attacked was something that at least caused a great deal of political effervescence in this country. We didn't actually do much about it. Disraeli defended the Turks against the Russians. But nevertheless, it was a thing which many people felt very passionate about in a way that I think they would not do now. They may feel passionate about Palestinians, but they would not, I think, feel the same kind of indignation about the treatment of Christians.
Why do you think that is? Why is the cause of the Palestinians so much more alive in people's imagination than, let's say, Christians in Nigeria or across Africa?
That's a very good point. Yeah, I mean, I don't think there's been. Well, I suppose we. One reason is that I suppose, and here I don't pretend to be any more than an observer. We feel that Israel is an extension of the West. And therefore, it's sort of our responsibility in a way that we don't feel is true of Nigeria. So I guess that's part of it. We think, well, we can do nothing about what's happening in northern Nigeria. We can do something about what's happening in Gaza.
Is Nigeria part of the Commonwealth?
Yeah. Yes.
So we don't actually have a feeling about Commonwealth, even though you could say something similar.
I suppose we would say that when... if Christian children in Nigeria get kidnapped by Muslim...
Islamists and Boko Haram, yeah.
Something that the Nigerian government can stop. Therefore, there's not much point in, you know, in calling in the Nigerian High Commissioner and shouting at him. It wouldn't do any good. We might be able to help in some way, but there's not much we can actually do. I suppose there's a feeling that we can do something about what's happening in Palestine. That's part of it, I think. I think a lot of it's based on a kind of anti-Americanism. Israel is seen as an extension of America. And for many people on the left, America is the source of trouble in the world. Mm. You know, American capitalism, American imperialism, and Israel is seen as an offshoot of that. That's why I think so many people on the left have jumped on the Palestinian bandwagon, as it were. Mm. It's now become... a sort of byword, you know, queers for Palestine. Here are people who would be, and indeed probably are, hated by the groups that they are supporting. Mm-hmm. But that's not why they're doing it. They're doing it because they feel it's part of some sort of, I don't know, crusade, or that's obviously the wrong word, some sort of campaign against Western imperialism. Mm-hmm. So if you can, and then obviously there's a big Muslim participation, mm-hmm. partly, I expect, well, in fact, it's visible, of Islamist activists. In some cases, at least from what I've seen, it appears to be Muslim families out with their children, feeling, I suppose, that this is a thing they ought to do, and perhaps, too, making it clear that they have a voice that they want to make heard. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, it's and then, you know, you have, and this is what you see on Cambridge Market every Saturday. It's become a sort of omnicause. Do you use that expression?
What do you mean by that?
I think Mary Harrington, the journalist, invented this. It's as if there's only one cause in the world.
Right.
So, you know, the Extinction Rebellion, trans rights for Palestinians, all this becomes part of the same cause because it's somehow all against the status quo, which is seen as oppressive and increasingly as vulnerable. Mm. I mean, I would say that one reason for the attacks on the West are that the West now seems open to attack in a way that it didn't, let's say, in the 1990s. Partly our own fault, but it's clearly now the West appears to be, in some sense, it's on the ropes, and therefore it's very tempting for people who were perhaps always very critical of, you know, capitalism, imperialism, all that, to now think this is their moment in which they can start really fighting back. And Palestine, at the moment, Palestine gives a very useful cause. It's not the first time this has happened. After all, you're all too young to remember this, but the Vietnam War, in which again people did not have any way of influencing the American policy in Vietnam, but thousands of students in the days when I was a student would demonstrate against the war in Vietnam, because once again this was seen as the most vulnerable tip of the American imperialist project, if one can call it that.
Yeah, so it's not just that these people are protesting against specific causes, but they actually want the whole system. They're using this as the vulnerable point to try and take down the whole system.
Yeah, I mean, I think, yes. I mean, I think there is what one could call a kind of progressive nihilism, in which it's thought that bring down the whole structure and it will be replaced by something better. Mm-hmm. And to get back to our history wars, you know, let's trash the whole of our history and start again with a sort of tabula rasa, in which we'll start with the arrival of the Empire Windrush, or we'll start at some, and then we'll kind of start again and tell a new story about ourselves, and that will be better. So I think that's a kind of desire to destroy the whole status quo in the hope or in the expectation that something better will come of it, which is again not a new impulse. It's a very old impulse. You get it in religious millenarianism. You got it in
what's religious millenarianism?
The belief that the end of the world was coming.
So
you got it in early Protestantism, when you got some very exotic religious sects who thought that this was marking the beginning of the end of the world. And therefore, you'd got to start living a perfect life. You'd got to rebel against what was seen as corrupt and oppressive structures. You even got this at the time of the French Revolution, which I think I can say not many people know this. But many of the English radicals who supported the French Revolution, most famously, I suppose, William Blake, the great artist, were members of really rather strange Protestant sects who thought that the French Revolution was the beginning of the end of the world, and then Jesus would return in glory to institute the reign of the saints. So, we might say, well, the French Revolution was about problems in the French peasantry. No, they would say it's really God's will that the established churches should be destroyed. And that's what the French Revolution is doing. And that's why we support it, whatever it does. You know, however many people it kills, it's essentially the will of God, and it's going to bring about a perfect society. And you got it at the time of the Russian Revolution, when, old Etonians went and spied for the Russians, as we know. Cambridge, the famous Cambridge spies, who were usually from a privileged upper middle class background, and who thought, well, yes, but communism is the wave of the future. We want to be part of the brave new world. And so I think you've often had waves of this kind of...
Was Bernard Shaw part of that set?
Well, Bernard Shaw, he was certainly someone who said very... what now seem absurd and rather immoral things about how he thought that democracy was a rotting corpse, and that fascism and communism were much better. So yes, there was that sort of sense in the interwar period that liberalism and liberal democracy had failed, and that they had to be replaced by, let's say, a more authoritarian and what was seen as a more effective system of remodeling the world. So we may be in a not dissimilar phase now, in which there are people who again feel that we're reaching a sort of end time, and what you really want is to bring the whole system crashing down and build a new one. I mean, I think this is a delusory view. Such things don't happen, or if they do, they cause disaster. And at least in the 1930s, you might say, well, you have the Soviet Union as a kind of model. As we know now, it was not a model that any normal person would wish to follow, but they didn't know that at the time. They thought it was wonderful. So at least you'd say, well, here's socialism that's actually working in Russia. Why can't we have it here? Now we have people, or some people, are trying to destroy the things that hold us together. I don't think they will succeed, but they're certainly doing some damage. But as far as I can see, they don't have any kind of replacement model in mind.
Well, some of them have communism as a replacement model. It seems to me, I've been in the masses, there's a lot of Socialist Worker Party represented on the marches in London every week, and the openly socialist, openly, some of them are openly Trotskyist and
yes,
communist.
Yes, I've seen them too.
Yeah.
So they seem to be everywhere, don't they? But there aren't very many of them.
Well, let's hope not.
Well, they must all turn up at all the marches. But yeah, I mean, somehow the Socialist Workers' Party seem to be able to produce banners and posters for almost every every dissenting movement that exists. Mm. But there, I don't think there are very many, and they certainly would have no chance of ever playing a political role.
I don't mean to be personalise it too rude, but part of me is frustrated at the historians because we have not educated these people. There's not been an education in what happened in China in the Cultural Revolution or in the Soviet Union, even the French Revolution. Are kids coming out of school having learnt all these things? That these ideas that socialism, or rather communism, is even still entertained? No one in their right mind would entertain Nazism now. No. But communism, which killed far more people, is still talked about. It's part, you know, there's a communist wing to the progressive movement. Yes.
And although there are people who try to say there's a threat from the extreme right, sort of, you know, neo-fascism, I think you're right in that this doesn't really exist or scarcely
well,
exist.
Well, no, sorry.
But as you say, you know, people... Well, so why is it that the there is still a sort of nostalgia in some circles for communism? Well, I think it's very difficult to say. Is it ignorance on the part of many people? I suppose it is. We are constantly taught, and rightly, at least we used to be, I hope we still are, about things like the Holocaust as a sort of origin of racism. Although the anti-Israel fervor being shown at the moment maybe shows that the shock of learning about the Holocaust has worn off, or that it's not any longer being communicated. But as to why a repeatedly failed experiment, a blatantly failed and destructive experiment, should still have its followers is quite difficult to understand. I mean, if you wanted me to take a guess, it would be that Marxism provides a kind of all-encompassing explanation for everything, and that this appeals to certain kinds of intellects. Mm. So I think it's the attraction of the theory. Mm-hmm. And you can always say, well, the theory's wonderful, it's just it hasn't really worked. It hasn't been properly applied yet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's all the fault of Stalin or Mao or whatever. So you can maintain the theory of the purity of the theory, even if it hasn't worked in practice. I guess it's something like that. I mean, I have a sort of pet theory, which I've never tried to elaborate, about why the left in Britain is... So, as Orwell pointed out in 1940, so unpatriotic. Okay, maybe many of them would say that they're not. They have a different kind of patriotism. But I think one answer I would suggest is that they've never really been much... They've never played a very prominent part in our history. If you think of our history, it's on the whole been one of... it's monarchs and aristocrats and generals... And it's been one of victory, and it's been one of empire, and it's been one of peaceful reform on the whole. Okay, there are exceptions, but on the whole, that's been our story. What's often called Whig history. Whereas in some countries, and I think of France, the country I probably know best, intellectuals are often fiercely patriotic. Mm. They're fiercely defensive of France, of French traditions, of French values. And I think I'd suggest it's because they've played a much more prominent part in French history from the Revolution onwards. Mm. And so intellectuals can think, well, the France that exists is in some ways our creation. I feel that British intellectuals often feel that they're very marginalised in our whole history and that therefore they don't feel any particular... loyalty to the country as it's come to be. But maybe that's not true.
I mean, it's difficult to say there's a right and left here, because I can think of plenty of left-wing patriotic people, like not least as far as they can be called left-wing, the Red Wall from the last election. Yes. Those are very much English patriots.
But not English intellectuals on the whole.
Well, I when you're speaking there, what came to mind was, I think it was about 10 years ago, Emily Thornberry had forced to quit from Miliband's shadow cabinet because she'd sneered at some St. George's crosses.
That's right.
Which were hanging over some
white van man.
Yeah, exactly. And then only last 2 weeks ago, Nike released a new England football shirt with the bisexual flag colours interwoven with St. George's cross. Now, setting that aside, there was a right wing, let's say, or patriotic, that's more accurate, pushback against that. But then you have the progressives who are can't understand why that would even be offensive. That because to them, I don't know if the St. George's Cross is, it's obviously not sacred to them, but it's curious to me how they are so triggered by anyone considering that important to them, the St. George's Cross being important to them.
Well, I guess, okay, to elaborate on my earlier thought, I think many people on the left, and if you like, many left-wing patriots, have a very different historical narrative. So let's say someone like, well, I hope I'm in the middle, kind of. But let's say if you were a conservative, you might say the history of Britain and of England have been, on the whole, successful. It's shown a high degree of internal peace. It's shown the willingness of people to compromise. It's shown the development of parliamentary institutions and liberties over the centuries. You know, a slow development, but usually without bloodshed, of a kind of liberal democracy. Whereas if you're on the left, your story becomes very different. Until quite recently, it would be essentially one of internal repression. You know, it would be the Tolpuddle martyrs, the Peterloo massacre, the trade unionists struggling for rights. It would be about Oliver Cromwell fighting against Charles I for the rights of Parliament. It would be about constant struggle by oppressed people for their rights. Mm-hmm. And that's a kind of patriotism. And I think in recent years, added to that would be the kind of decolonization narrative. So you don't only say the British aristocracy were grinding down the faces of the poor in Britain. You say they were also the people who were exploiting slavery and exploiting conquered territories and so on. So you know, you have what was once could be seen as a fairly optimistic left-wing narrative, which is how, after all, after centuries of struggle, at last the people win their rights. Now it becomes a much darker picture of constant oppression and tyranny, with very little to show as success. And the other thing, I suppose, and stop me if I'm talking too much about history, we did have a kind of consensual historical narrative, which is often called Whig history. I don't know whether you know that expression. It was the history of the Whig Party, and it was essentially about, as I say, it's about the as Tennyson put it, the broadening down of freedom from precedent to precedent. So eventually, the great heroes of this are those who are struggling for parliamentary rights, for parliamentary reform in the 19th century, and eventually we get to the point, you know, in about the early 20th century, in which we have democracy, women have the vote, Parliament governs, we're prosperous, we're successful, etc. The happy ending has kind of gone. We are no longer the most powerful country in the world, if we ever were, which I have some doubts about. We are no longer the richest country in Europe. We are no longer a country in which everything seems to work very well. Again, maybe that was never the case. So I think, you know, the idea that our history has been one of struggle ending with success, I think it's very easy to tell it now as being one of struggle and oppression, which doesn't end in success. It just ends in more struggle and oppression. And the latest form of oppression is colonial oppression. And I think this has become an inherent part of a left-wing history of Britain. Whether it's a patriotic left-wing history of Britain, I'm not so sure. I think it's often a very definitely anti-patriotic history, in which you would say, well, even if it's true that English workers had their rights, it's only because slaves and colonial peoples were being oppressed. And if one were to say, well, okay, the empire also, didn't it also do some good things? Didn't it end slavery? Didn't it bring peace and order? Didn't it promote economic development? Either those things are completely denied, or it's said that they are hugely outweighed by the violence, the oppression, and so on.
Why do you think they're denied?
Because otherwise these wouldn't fit the needs of the narrative. If I'm right, you know, what you need. Okay, now perhaps I'm constructing a straw man, some of your viewers may say, but let's for the sake of argument, let's say that there are people who would like to weaken any idea of national pride, national solidarity, and are looking forward to a more, let's say, a more cosmopolitan, a much more far more rootless sense of existence. You know what David Goodhart in his book called anywhere people. People who don't really want to feel attached to a particular country or a particular place. They feel themselves citizens of the world or whatever. So they're quite happy to tell a story of their nation. It's true in other countries too, which is essentially a bad one, because then you have a good reason for saying, I don't feel any particular loyalty for this place or these people. We haven't talked about Brexit, but the Brexit vote is an obvious case of this kind of division, I think. But so you have a negative narrative of the whole country's history of one of oppression and exploitation. Mm. So you might say, well, so why do they want to deny that there are any good sides? Well, simply because otherwise the narrative doesn't really work. Mm-hmm. Now, are children being taught this at school? I think to some extent they are. Whether the children remember what they're taught at school or whether they take much notice of what their teachers say, I'm not sure. I think when I was a child, we probably didn't. But maybe they're much better at learning things now. Because I think there is a fear that that a whole generation of children is being brought up on a certain historical narrative.
A very anti-English. I'm certainly concerned about it, which I've mentioned earlier in this conversation.
Yeah.
And maybe you've got insight into the syllabus of Britain, but if they're being given this anti-English narrative without any of the positives, that's worse than having all the positives without any of the negatives.
Yes, which you probably got in Victorian right. times, in which England was the best country in the world, the apex of civilization, etc., etc. Yes, we've gone to the other extreme, partly as a reaction, but I think also, part of it's the desire to be inclusive. You say, well, look, you know, in my class, we've got lots of children who come from other parts of the world. They don't really want to hear about how wonderful England or Britain was. They want to hear about how their countries were oppressed and how their national myth can be told. And I think we probably have to accept the fact that because of its importance historically, Britain plays the part of the villain in many countries' national origin myths. Even America, if we assume America's our great ally, even Australia, you know, fighting back against the Brits or asserting your independence of the Brits is part of that story. So we end up as being the bad guys in an awful lot of historical narratives.
And also the good guys in a lot of historical narratives. Hong Kong, Singapore.
Yes.
We're very positive.
I agree, they are.
You're starting to sound like one of the progressive anti-English
Well, I'm being the devil's advocate in
right,
a way.
Right, sorry.
And I think we have been, and for reasons I'm not entirely sure of, we have been much more willing to accommodate other people's stories than to insist on our own. I think, for example, if one's to take the example of American independence, insofar as children learn about it at all, or we read about it, or we see it on television, or we read about it in the media, it's usually seen as a struggle for freedom against George III and British oppression. Things that don't fit into this narrative, as for example, very many slaves joined in on the side of the British. Most of Native Americans were on the side of the British. A very large part of the American population was on the side of the British. And a major reason why for the rebellion was a desire to expand, to colonize territories further west, which the British government was trying to limit. So the simple story of American struggles for independence or freedom don't fit all the facts. In fact, they may not fit most of the facts. But it's very rare for any British person to say, well, hang on a minute, what about all the slaves who are on our side? What about what about all the Indians who are on our side? You know, so I think we kind of go for the. I think one could say a similar thing for Ireland. Did the Irish fight for their independence? Well, home rule had already been agreed. And yet we accept, I think, this idea that the Irish had to throw off the British yoke by force, all that kind of thing. And again, we don't know or we're not inclined to press our own version of things. History teaching in schools, I think, has not always been our strong point. And I think it's because we've sort of taken our history for granted. We didn't really feel it was all that necessary. to teach British history or to try to teach it in a particular way or to guard against what I would think of as distortions. So what do kids do at school? They do the Tudors and Stuarts. They do Hitler and the Third Reich. You might say, well, that's not an adequate historical basis of knowledge for people who are going to be citizens of a democratic country. They ought to know a lot more about their own country's history and something about other parts of the world, sure. But I think often this is not done. And I feel this leaves us rather vulnerable to having versions of the past foisted on us because we just don't know any better. Mm. And I think we're not a very historically conscious culture compared with, say, the French, and I would guess the Italians and the Spanish, who are often seem rather obsessed by their history. Mm. You wouldn't find a French school child who'd never heard of the French Revolution. Mm. But I expect you would find very, very many of their British equivalents who'd never heard of the Glorious Revolution or who couldn't say what it was. Or who didn't know why there'd been a civil war between the king and parliament, or we just don't know our history, and we quite like visiting old houses, which is why the National Trust has got itself into hot water lately, because people want to go to a nice house. They don't want to have to be told it was all built with the proceeds of slavery. They want to see but they're not really interested in the history, I feel, and I don't think we as a culture are terribly historically minded. People dip into bits of history, but they don't. But we don't feel it necessary. We've never felt it necessary to teach it in a systematic way.
So it's not the collective memory idea. Isn't so much, you don't think that's such a big part of Englishness? Then
I rather feel it ought to be. Mm. And I think probably in a society which is much more heterogeneous than it was, we probably ought to try to make it more central. Because as Mill and Renan say, these are things that hold us together. At a time when we didn't feel we need anything to hold us together, because we were a pretty homogeneous society, you didn't need to bother about this. You could study the history of the ancient world, or not do any history at all, and it didn't really matter. Now I think probably it matters a bit more, or indeed rather a lot more. And so I think we ought to make more of an effort to make sure that children are given the basics of our national history, as their in a sense their intellectual property, their cultural property.
One thing that you said earlier that alarms me a little bit is that, for the sake of inclusion, there is a hesitancy to teach English and British history to students lest they feel excluded. I guess a broader question around that would be: in the context of last year, 700,000 net migrants to Britain, and the year just gone, just under that, 670,000, with this huge influx of people to Britain, can they adopt English history as their own?
It's a very good question, and I think it's quite a complicated one. I'm a French historian originally, and one of the very famous stories about French history in the 19th century is that they used to teach little children in Algeria or in Senegal about our ancestors, the Gauls, in the sense that they were expected to adopt French history as their own history. And so the question would be, if you're a child whose parents or grandparents come from Pakistan or Nigeria, is the history of King Alfred your history? And I would say, yes, it becomes your history once you become a citizen of this country. On the other hand, should you exclude the history of the Indian subcontinent and of Africa? And I would say no. And I remember once giving a talk in a school after my book came out. And at the end of it, a young sixth former girl came up to me and said, my parents came from East Africa. They were, Kenyan Asians. And I never really felt that my family were part of British history. And I said, yes, but your family history is a crucial part of it. And I think we do have to tell the story that includes the people who are now our fellow citizens. And of course, the history of the empire, therefore, is a very important one to teach. And it cannot be, or it should not be taught, as simply a story of oppression. It's also a story of cooperation, of exchange, of improvement. Mm-hmm. Okay, some of it was bad, a lot of it was good, and I think people are are or ought to be mature enough to accept that history is not either a fairy story or a, you know, or a story of the devil incarnate, that there are all sorts of shades of grey and there are complexities and difficulties, and that's an important reason for studying history. Mm. So I think we do need to have a proper, I would hope we will have a proper history curriculum. Indeed, if dare I say, I'm on an advisory committee that is helping to draw up a model history curriculum for the use of schools. Mm. And we are trying to do this in a way that means that children actually learn quite a lot of history, and that history will be fundamentally based on the history of Britain, but it will also include the history of other parts of the world, and it will certainly, I hope, in its later stages, include the history of the empire. Mm. And of the 20th century. Because mm. I think that's the sort of thing that children now really do need to know if we're to live in a society which wishes to and which can integrate mm. quite a large diversity of people.
Do you think that the British people should adopt the incoming people, their history, as part of their own? I'll give you an example. In the period of statues being pulled down, one statue was erected commemorating the families of the Windrush generation. I think it's in Waterloo Station, with a Windrush family together. And I think that's fantastic, because that is part of British history. Yes. And the English should adopt that as part of their history. I'd also say Jamaica, it's part of the Commonwealth.
Yes.
It's British in a sense. They consider themselves British. That is our history. And before answering, I'll give you a counterexample. In America, and this is something I'm really concerned about, is they're splitting everyone up into having different histories. And yes. Black History Month is an example of this. A whole month where this people's history is different from this people's history. Yes. Instead of coming together and being like, we are one nation and we should assimilate all of these histories into one and accept that these are all part of our history. So I'm concerned about what's happening in America. Do you share that concern?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think to some extent here too.
Of course we have Black History Month here.
Yeah. We do, yeah. But we don't have, for example, Polish History Month. We don't have, you know, where do you stop if you're going to start teaching a whole lot of separate histories of a whole lot of ethnic minorities? Now, I think ideally you should bring it together into one history. Mm. And I think that was one of the conclusions of the CRED report, the Sewell report on race relations in Britain, which came out how many years ago? A few years ago. That we should be teaching a history that is a history of all. I think we should. And I think we could. But I think, you know, I think the black... I've never been involved in teaching Black History Month, but some of the things one hears strike me as being a little bit patronising. That, for example, the Roman soldiers on Hadrian's Wall, that many of them were black. Well, if they were, fine. If that were the,
were
if
any
that
of them black?
Well, they were from North Africa.
Yeah, but 2,000 years ago.
Yeah, exactly, 2,000 years ago. So they were part of the Greco-Roman world. They would have been largely, some would have been Berbers, probably some would have been Phoenicians, Greeks from the Mediterranean world. But they were not black Africans, you know. And yet you can see a well-meaning desire to make people feel that this is their history. But I feel that this is often done by the invention of pious mythologies, which I don't think one ought to do, because I don't think children need to be told fairy stories. They're old enough, or they're capable of learning the truth. And the truth, after all, is quite an inspiring one, as you were saying. The arrival of the Empire Windrush generation is the beginning of a very exciting new period for those people. And it's one that ought to be told as what it was, a very new development in our history, the opening of a new period of our history, and not saying, oh, well, yes, you know, the Henry VIII had a black trumpeter and the Romans had a lot of black soldiers. Well, no, they probably didn't.
I'm concerned with, and forgive me if we just linger a little bit on the education of the children, because we're spreading what I think is a divisive history, and we're constantly saying diversity is our greatest strength. And I happen to believe that unity is our greatest strength. And so what I'm keen to, and I've asked you twice now already, so I'm not going to careful to get into what is it to be English, but maybe a slightly different way of phrasing it is, what is it to be British? And, well, there's one wonderful thing I picked up from your book was that I never knew this, but the word British, you draw it back all the way from a Greek explorer in 320 BC, and he came up with the word pretanike.
Yes.
Which was what the Celts, a word to use the Celts, that they had tattoos. Yes. I'm thrilled about, because I'm not particularly ethnically English, but I have tattoos and long hair, and I think that's maybe what the indigenous English British look like.
To have a tattoo history.
Well, quite. is being British rather than English an identity that we can, is easier for us all to partake in?
I think it is, in the sense that it's a political identity. Oh. Britain is in a sense a nation of nations, but Britain, the United Kingdom, is essentially a political construct, as we know. And I think it doesn't have quite the same, in fact, I say this in the book, it doesn't have quite the same emotional ring to it as Scottish, Welsh, Irish, or English. Yeah. I think I might quote Robert Browning's poem, which begins, "Oh, to be in England now that April's there." And if you were to say, "Oh, to be in Britain now that April's there," it would somehow not sound right. Mm-hmm. And if Nelson had said, "Britain expects that every man will do his duty," again, it wouldn't have the same emotional tug. So I think to be Scottish, or to be Welsh, or to be Irish, or to be English, has a kind of, it appeals to something rather deep inside you. Whereas British is something, in some ways, it's for the outside world. It's not for one's internal feelings. At least that's how it seems to me.
I speak to a lot of people my contemporaries and my peers find it easier to identify as being British rather than English. I personally would say I'm English before I was British. Where are you? Would you say you're English?
I think this is, polls show that people are tending more to identify themselves as primarily Scottish, English, Irish, or Welsh,
really? Okay.
Than British. So I think there has been a blow to Britishness, which is partly the rise of nationalism in other parts of the United Kingdom, not yet in England, though there's some greater sense of English identity than there was in the past. You mentioned football a few times, and I think it's the case that, I don't know, 20, 30 years ago, you would have had English football or rugby crowds waving the Union Jack, and now they wave the flag of St. George. And this is partly because of greater consciousness of the rise of a more assertive sense of identity in the other parts of the United Kingdom. But I think the English too have become more aware of themselves as different. Sport is obviously quite important in this.
I think I can hear my progressive friends in my ear, and they would maybe have a kickback at the concept of Englishness because there might be an ethnic component to that. Do you think there is an ethnic component to being English? Can anyone be an Englishman? Is Rishi Sunak, our Prime Minister, not an Englishman?
I'd have thought he was. Because, as I said earlier, I quoted Roger Scruton, and I go along with this view that England is our home. Of course, you could say Britain is our home too. Europe is our home, but in a particular way, England is our home. And so I would say anyone who feels that this country is the country that I live in, this country is the country that I feel some sense of duty and gratitude towards, that means, and perhaps you could also say, if you're accepted by other people as being English, then you are English. I think that most people would think of Rishi Sunak as English because, for one thing, he sounds English. You know, accents and voices are unusually important in the way we identify people, in a way that's not true in all countries. I was in Australia recently, and someone said to me, another Australian said this wasn't true, but someone said to me, you can't tell where in Australia someone comes from by the way they speak, whereas, of course, here you immediately can. So I think that if you sound English, you are English, and that people would immediately identify you as a Londoner or a Scouser or whatever, because of whatever your colour, because of your sound. And I think for many of us, that kind of other kind of cultural signifier, to sound a bit pretentious, is more important than skin colour. Whereas I think probably in America, I expect skin colour is the thing that, above all, people identify by.
for you on a personal level, what is it to be? What are you patriotic about?
Well, I've often thought about this, because you said I wrote a book about England. I'd spent most of my career writing about France. And I have French citizenship through my marriage. Many of my friends are French. I think in some ways I'm an epitome of what David Goodhart calls an anywhere person. I'd be quite happy living in France. I'd be quite happy living in Australia. I think I could even manage America, though I'm not sure I'd want to go there at the moment. But so what is it for me to be English? Yeah. And I think it probably is a sense of belonging, a sense of this is where my roots, family roots lie. The institution that I've spent most of my life working in is a very English institution. And so there are lots of things that connect you with a place, I think.
Do you think you're losing? Are we losing your concept of England? I go back to the opening Telegraph piece that you wrote, but I it was almost a eulogy. It was a sense of mourning in the writing that this is an England that we are on the brink of losing.
I think the English have always been a fairly globe-trotting people. Large amounts of emigration. People are happy to go to America, Australia, and so on. So I'm not sure that we have been a very, I think we have been a rather footloose lot, and have often also been fairly willing to tolerate foreigners. Footloose in the sense that until recently the French, and I keep talking about them because I do know France quite well, were not. It was very rare for French people to go and live in other countries. It was rare for French students to study abroad. It was rare for people to migrate. All that's changed quite suddenly in a generation. But we have, I think, for a long time been fairly detached. You know, people used to go and live in Australia and talk about the home country. And you had colonial officers who'd spent 40 years in India and then talked about coming home to live in Brighton or something. You know, there's a rather loose connection, I think, often with the idea of home. Perhaps because English has become a global culture. You can go to India, as I have done on several occasions, and immediately feel that you're quite at home because you can make yourself understood and people will speak to you in English, and English is their language as well as yours. The architecture is often very similar. In both directions there's been architectural influence. So I do feel actually quite at home in India. In a way that I probably wouldn't, or I don't think I necessarily would in Bavaria, let's say. though, of course, many people would say the opposite. Many people feel or say they feel very European. And we saw that over the whole Brexit debate. Though my scepticism about this is that people who say they feel terribly European very rarely seem to speak any European languages. it's very easy to feel European when you're on holiday. Mm. And you only speak to waiters in restaurants. But how deep a feeling can you have if you don't understand the language and the culture? Whereas if you go to New Zealand or, as I say, to India, you'll find quite a lot that is familiar.
Do you think there's a crossover with those who, English and British, who say they feel European? Are they the same people who are kind of icky about the fact that they're English?
Yes.
Is it timed into the same phenomena we've talked about earlier? Is that kind of trying to, I don't know, what a hatred, trying to tear down what it is to be England or English? What is the energy? What's at play there?
Well, I think, again, I've mentioned David Goodhart's book a couple of times, called The Road to Somewhere, in which he makes a distinction between somewhere people and anywhere people. And I think this applies to many developed countries, or perhaps all of them, in which there are people who feel quite closely tied to a particular place, a country, but also to a region or a city or a village. And those who are like us, like all of us probably here, who in fact would be very happy moving around and living in different countries and different places, because our education and so on has kind of formed us to be international. And for some people feel that very deeply and feel that they want to be part of a cosmopolitan culture and not part of a national or a regional culture. And I think...
I mean, it is a region, so there's a kind of irony to it, is that they want to be associated with Western civilization, but, you know, they don't. Yeah. They're not saying, oh, no, all of humanity. No, they're being like, no, we're European. So they're actually being quite regional, quite identitarian, somewhat identitarian about it.
Yes, though it's at least not an English identity. So
well, quite.
I suppose they see it as better and more sophisticated.
Probably, in some ways it is.
I mean, I think one could go into that quite a lot, which we haven't got time to do. But why would people who feel so much part of a cosmopolitan society often be quite anti-American and yet very pro-European? And there again, you have politics coming into it in a certain sense of what the world is like and who are the people who run it, so which we can't go into.
For another interview.
Maybe. I think there's a class element too. That clearly came out, I think, after the 2016 vote, in which many of those who were most angered by the vote put it down to the ignorance of, you know, vaguely white working class people in provincial towns that Londoners would never want to visit, wouldn't even know where they were. Mm. And that these were the people who were sort of these left behind people who were holding we university educated cosmopolitans back from our destiny as being part of this great new world of without boundaries. Mm. And I think there was a lot of that to it. In fact, I'm not sure if I mentioned in that book, but one of the things that got me involved in this, because I was not particularly politically active person before, was going to a party in Newnham, which is a slightly middle bourgeois part of Cambridge, very academic. And I was talking to a lady over a glass of wine, and she said, "I've at last understood how it is that people could vote for Brexit." She said, "Because I got my cleaning lady and my gardener to explain it to me."
And
I thought, right, you have to try and do something about this.
Let's talk about two more things. Yeah. I want to get to the newest edition of your book, but before that, you mentioned History Reclaimed earlier, and I thought it might be worth just explaining what that is in a little bit more detail. This is your attempt to change the syllabus for...
Well, History Reclaimed is not involved in the syllabus thing. I'm involved in that as an individual who's part of an advisory committee. But History Reclaimed is a little group of historians who we sort of discovered each other, and we thought that much of what was being said and indeed taught was a distortion, and a distortion with a particular ideological aim, which is what we've been talking about.
Everything's talking about Britain being racist, all the colonization.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, and we thought this was damaging, and we also thought it was untrue. After all, we're professional historians, and we tend to think that trying to tell the full truth is a professional duty. Mm-hmm. So you need to look at the evidence. You need to try to balance different aspects of the question. You shouldn't produce a partial or an oversimplified story. So that's what we do. That's what we try to do. We publish quite a lot of material online, and we're going to have a day conference fairly soon in July, I think.
Open to the public?
It will be open to, yes, there'll be limited numbers, but it will be open to the public, and we shall be publicising it on our website in due course. But yes, we shall be having discussions about these sorts of things. But anyway, we set this up, this little group, which is essentially trying to correct what we see as oversimplifications and simply, occasionally, falsehoods. Not necessarily deliberate falsehoods, but things that have been put forward as true and which can be shown to be false. One thing that we haven't dealt with yet, because it's all happening quite recently, is the Church of England's decision to pay a vast amount of money in compensation or reparation for its involvement in the slave trade. Well, there is some evidence, which seems to me quite convincing, or at least worth taking into account, which is that the Church of England never invested in the slave trade and never derived any income from slavery. Huh. And therefore the idea that it owes £100 million in penitence or reparation...
And talk of a billion, by the way.
Talk of a billion.
Yeah.
Is simply... has no foundation at all. So how could they have come to make this decision? And I think the answer has to be this is a decision that they were very... they were very much inclined to come to before looking at the evidence, and therefore found the evidence that fitted their preconceived wish to be seen to be renouncing what they saw as a sinful past, but a past that seems not to be all that sinful after all.
But what's their evidence that they are complicit in the slave trade?
Well, that they had investments, or the church had investments in the South Sea Company, which was trading both goods and slaves with the Spanish colonies. But it seems that the church, and this is something that has to be investigated rather thoroughly, it seems that the church's investments were not in that aspect of the company's activities at all. The church had in fact invested in what we would now call gilts, in government securities, and the government had passed over its portfolio to the South Sea Company, but had nothing to do with slavery and had nothing to do with the slave trade. So the church, if this proves to be true, the church in fact was not involved in the slave trade.
Wow.
But, you know, there are institutions, great institutions like the University of Cambridge, which have been very keen to prove their sins, or at least the sins of their ancestors. And I think if you were to tell the story of Cambridge and slavery, you would have to come to the conclusion that the university itself was not involved in slavery or the slave trade, but it was very much involved in abolitionism. Indeed, this college, if I can give my college, St. John's, a plug, had two of the most famous abolitionists, who were William Wilberforce and Clarkson.
Wilberforce Thomas Clarkson. Was here.
Yeah, Wilberforce was a student here. Thomas Clarkson was also a student here. So these were the two great campaigners in the early days for abolition. And the two politicians who did a great deal to end the Atlantic slave trade were Lord Aberdeen, who was also a student here, who declared that slavery was piracy and that the Royal Navy could therefore stop any suspected slave ship. And Lord Palmerston, who eventually sent in the Navy into Brazilian ports and destroyed their slave ships.
Huh.
So
now there's a proud history.
But it wasn't the one that the university at that time really wanted to come up with. It wanted to come up with a sort of self-flagellating story about how wicked it had been, in order to say, yes, but we are very good now. You know, our ancestors were very wicked, but we, in contrast, are very good. And I don't think that's a really very honourable, and certainly not an intellectually very strong position to take.
Particularly shocking for the church, because it's just virtue signalling and something we discussed off
air. Well, yes. Well, I mean, you may remember the parable of the Pharisee and the publican that Jesus told, about how the Pharisee goes into the temple and walks up to the front and says, "Lord, I thank thee that I am not as other men, that I am not like this wicked publican here. I'm a good guy and he's a bad guy." And of course, Jesus condemns this. It's not for you to say what a good person you are. And I'm afraid that we do stray into that area. And I think the church should be the last institution to do that. If it really feels that it has money that it should spend on the underprivileged, I think it needs to decide who really these underprivileged people are, and not simply give it to an undisclosed recipient for reasons that seem to be extremely weak.
Or perhaps we could have a conversation about slavery today, contemporary slavery.
Well, of course, there is that too.
Tens of millions in slaves.
And of course, the church might feel some responsibility for all the serfs it exploited over the centuries, some of whose children are indeed among the most underprivileged in our society. Mm. You know, we know that white working class boys are the most disadvantaged group. Many of them will be the descendants of serfs who worked on the estates of the nobility, certainly, but also the estates of the church. Mm-hmm. The church was very reluctant. Okay, this was the pre-Reformation church, but the Church of England regards itself as that church. The church was extremely reluctant to give up its rights over its serfs, including some Cambridge colleges, though not mine, because it wasn't founded until after the end of serfdom.
When did the church finally give up its...
Oh, well, serfdom died out after the Black Death, largely because there was a shortage of labour, and serfs that's cleared off if they weren't given their freedom. But it lasted till the early 16th century in a few places, particularly, I think, church and monastic establishments. But I'm not an expert on that.
Uh-huh. Let's talk about the new edition.
Oh, right.
Of your great initiative. I read the older edition. Tell me about this wonderful, look at this beautiful turquoise cover.
Cambridge blue, I suppose.
What's different about this one from the other?
The other one stopped in 2014, at about the time of the Scottish referendum. And so, as we know, an awful lot has happened since then. Brexit, the pandemic, the war in Ukraine, and all the political consequences of those things. So I felt it really ought to be brought up to date. Otherwise, you know, the trouble is with writing books that go up to the present day is that they are, from the day of publication, they start to become obsolescent. And this one had clearly become, I thought, when you got to the end of it, you would feel, well, you know, I'm being shortchanged here because so much has happened since. So I shortened what was previously the last chapter, and I added a new chapter that brings it up to the time of the coronation. So it does include Brexit, and it does include the pandemic, and it does include the beginnings of the war in Ukraine.
And is it as pessimistic as the Telegraph article, or is there more?
I'm not wholly pessimistic. I mean, I think we're in a dangerous place. And the thing that worries me is that we seem not to be able to grapple with this situation. We've become very comfortable because of, most obviously, a long period of peace and prosperity. I think we're very reluctant to realise dangers. Perhaps people always are. Democracies or even pre-democracies with representative governments are very reluctant to make people pay more taxes. You know, Gladstone, again, to get back to him, he was a constant reducer of taxation. He didn't want to spend money on the armed forces. He didn't want to spend money on the empire. He wanted a world in which there would be peaceful commerce, a globalised world, rather as we thought was going to happen in Tony Blair's time. Mm. So I think democracies and states with representative government are very reluctant to face up to unwelcome news. And I think we are now in a position of, not only us, of political disarray. That's true all over the West, it seems to me. And also, as we were saying earlier, of cultural division and a lack of a sense of common purpose. And all that makes it more difficult, I think, to stand up to threats. But one day, I suppose we shall have to, or if we don't, we shall suffer the consequences. And historians don't like telling the future, so I'm not going to say what will happen. But I think we can see what the dangers are. And we can all think of the things that might happen and the things that we hope we can manage to avert.
Well, on that note, Robert Toombs, a pleasure, a privilege to speak with you.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure to speak to you, Winston. Thank you very much for asking me. It's been
fun. I'm going to implore listeners and viewers to get the new edition. The version I have read is superb. And as we discussed a little bit, collective memory is what we need for social cohesion. So it seems now more important than ever. So Robert Toombs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to The Winston Marshall Show with me, Winston Marshall. If you enjoyed that episode, I humbly ask that you like, share, and subscribe. But otherwise, stay tuned. There'll be more coming soon.